This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Protesters gather outside a court where the trial of former Minneapolis officer charged with the killing of African-American George Floyd started. A monitoring group says more than 500 people have been killed in Myanmar junta's crackdown on protests against the February 1st coup. Senior official said Iran will not stop any of its current nuclear activities before the lifting of all sanctions. This comes after a report on a U.S. plan to offer some sanctions relief. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Black Lives Matter protesters have gathered outside the court where the former Minneapolis police officer charged with the killing of African-American George Floyd has gone on trial. The protesters demanded justice for the black man who died in May 2020 after Derek Chauvin kneeled on his neck for about 9 minutes. The demonstrations were held as the first day of Chauvin's trial wrapped up following a technical issue. The white police officer is now facing murder and manslaughter charges. During the first day of the trial, a prosecuting attorney said Chauvin betrayed his badge.
Mr. Derek Chauvin betrayed this badge when he used excessive and unreasonable force upon the body of Mr. George Floyd.
Video, television, social media, or any other media.
Blackwell said Chauvin did not follow police procedures and acted callously. Prior to the opening of the court session, the Floyd family's lawyer described the trial as a referendum on the U.S. justice system. George Floyd's death, which was filmed by bystanders, rocked the United States and led to widespread protests against police mistreatment of African Americans. Earlier in our news review, we discussed the murder of George Floyd and the trial of the white police officer responsible for his death. Let's take a listen.
Close Colin Campbell is our correspondent from Washington, D.C., who joins us to give us the latest on that. And we also have Omali Yeshitela, who's the founder of Uhuru Movement, who joins us from St. Petersburg, Florida. Colin, at this point, we've heard the opening statement that is ongoing by the lawyer. I forget his name, Jerry. I forget his last name.
Benjamin Crump. Benjamin Crump.
And Crump, exactly. What type of coverage will we see? Is it going to be widespread? We heard the judge talk about the daily coverage that's going to happen. Is that how the media outlets across the states will cover this?
Yeah, most definitely. As we know that this is going to be a much anticipated trial in the prosecution of Derek Chauvin, and to see if there will really be any justice. Of course, ultimate justice won't be served because George Floyd will still be dead, but will there be as close as there can be to justice with the prosecution and the incarceration of a former police officer who is accused of killing an unarmed black man? So many times we've seen this happen over and over again, ending in an acquittal where some police are able to return to their jobs, where they get really a slap on the wrist for taking the life of an individual who is unarmed. Well, with the opening arguments that we heard from prosecuting attorney Jerry Blackwell and from the prosecuting team, we have heard that they are going to bring in a myriad of experts talking about how the knee on the back of George Floyd for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. I know this is a little bit different timing than we've heard repeated over and over again, but according to the prosecuting attorney, it was almost 9.5 minutes that the knee was on the back of George Floyd, and how that could have led to his death. Most of us already have seen the video, but for some of these jury members, they may not be as familiar as a lot of Americans are. And they'll bring in experts, they'll bring in members of various police, the police force, to talk about policing policies and how Chauvin didn't follow them. They'll bring in medical experts to talk about the stress that was put on Floyd's system. They said that this will, and that how it all came about, the counterfeit $20 bill, and not even really saying that George Floyd knew that the bill was counterfeit, that it could have been just a violation, a misdemeanor, where he could have been given a ticket, and the courts could have totally processed this claim, and that could have been the end of it. But what it led to, obviously, was Floyd's death over a $20 bill that could or could not have been counterfeit. And we'll hear from this, and this will definitely be covered by the media throughout the next several days, if not weeks.
Okay, Omali Yeshitela, obviously the stage is set now. We're looking at this trial. The world is watching. And you have had the family lawyer who talked about this say that this is going to be a trial that is a referendum of the American justice system. Do you think justice is going to prevail?
I think if we recognize that the United States government has a colonial relationship with African people in the United States, then we can say justice will prevail, but it will be the justice of a colonizer, because the colonizer is incapable of actually bringing justice to the colonized. And if we want to look at a referendum for the American justice system, I think the May 25th murder of George Floyd represents a part of the referendum on the justice system. Just as the murder of Mike Brown, just as the murder of so many other Africans who I've spoken to you about over the last few years. It happens regularly, happens all the time, and it is justice from their perspective. There is an entire industry that has grown up where entrepreneurs, in particular lawyers, make a lot of money off of these murders. And even the discussion about this as some kind of referendum of justice is something that suggests that the American justice system, as it's characterized, is usually something that can be seen as okay, but this will be a defining issue, and it's never okay.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. Omali Yeshitela, founder of Uhuru Movement from St. Petersburg, Florida. Also like to thank Colin Campbell, our correspondent there, who was talking to us from Washington, D.C. Thanks to both of you. And that brings us to the end of this news review.
Welcome back. The Brazilian president has been forced to replace several ministers in the biggest cabinet reshuffle since he took power in January 2019. Jair Bolsonaro replaced six cabinet members, including the foreign and defense ministers, who both resigned on Monday. The shakeup comes as the far-right leader faces mounting pressure due to a deadly surge of COVID-19 in the country. In Brazil, the average weekly death toll has nearly quadrupled since the start of the year. The South American nations also remain, or nation, I should say, also remains the world's second worst country in terms of COVID-19 deaths and infections after the U.S. Brazil's official death toll now stands at nearly 314,000, and the total number of cases is above 12.5 million. A monitoring group in Myanmar says more than 500 people have so far been killed in the junta crackdown on anti-coup protests there. The Assistant Association for Political Prisoners says the real toll could be significantly higher. UN Chief Antonio Guterres has said it is absolutely unacceptable to see violence against people at such high levels. He has called for a united global front to put pressure on Myanmar's junta. The US, Britain, and the EU have already imposed sanctions in response to the coup and crackdown. The military, however, has refused to ease it off. It staged a coup on February the 1st on election fraud and detained civilian leaders. Protests have continued unabated since then, calling for civilian rule. The Chinese parliament has approved sweeping reforms to Hong Kong's electoral system. The reforms have been signed into law by President Xi Jinping. They reduce the number of directly elected seats in Hong Kong's local parliament to 20 from the current 35. That provides room for some 30 seats to be occupied by representatives of various industries. The reforms also require Hong Kong's candidates for office to be approved by a joint vetting committee from both the city and China. The changes were announced earlier this month. Beijing says they are necessary to ensure that only patriots govern Hong Kong. The city has witnessed anti-government protests in the past months. China says it welcomes a visit by UN officials to the Xinjiang region amid a row with the West over the alleged abuse of the country's Uyghur Muslim minority there.
The door to Xinjiang is always open. We welcome the visit of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights to Xinjiang. China has already issued an invitation to the High Commissioner for Human Rights to visit China and visit Xinjiang. The two sides have been in communication. The purpose of the visit is to promote exchanges and cooperation between the two parties and not to carry out so-called investigations based on presumption of guilt.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry made the reaction after UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for unfettered access to Xinjiang to verify reports of human rights abuses in the region. Meanwhile, officials in Xinjiang accused Western countries of trying to contain China under the pretext of human rights issues.
The European Union, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada have ganged up to use Xinjiang-related issues to engage in political manipulation. The goal is to mess up Xinjiang and contain China under the guise of human rights.
The Chinese official slammed unilateral sanctions against Xinjiang as aimed at undermining the region's stability and hindering China's development. Several Western nations and the European Union have imposed sanctions on China, accusing Beijing of violating the rights of Uyghurs in camps in Xinjiang. China has reacted by imposing retaliatory sanctions. Beijing says the rights violation allegations have been leveled with the aim of spreading lies and disinformation. Tehran reiterates that the only path to reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal is for the U.S. to lift all sanctions on the country. This after a new report in U.S. media and Washington said Washington plans to make a new proposal to Iran. More in this report.
A senior Iranian official said that Tehran will stop its 20% uranium enrichment only if the U.S. lifts all its sanctions on the Islamic Republic first. The official said Tehran will further reduce its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal if the U.S. does not end all sanctions, warning that Washington is rapidly running out of time. Their remarks are in response to a report published in Politico that said Washington is to offer a new proposal to Tehran to jumpstart the talks on the nuclear deal as soon as this week. This comes as the Iranian president has already rejected the notion of talks on the nuclear deal. Hassan Rouhani said, since Washington did not sit for talks when it left the deal, its return to the agreement also merits no negotiations, but a mere political will.
The proposal asks Iran to halt some of its nuclear activities, such as work on advanced centrifuges and the enrichment of uranium to 20% purity, in exchange for some relief from U.S. economic sanctions.
After a year of full compliance with the agreement following U.S. withdrawal, Iran gradually started to scale down its nuclear deal commitments because the European parties to the accord, under pressure from the U.S., failed to meet their obligations. Iran says its countermeasures conform to the terms of the deal that allows one side to reduce commitments when others do not honor theirs. Since taking office, U.S. President Joe Biden has followed his predecessor Donald Trump's policies vis-a-vis the Iran nuclear deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Experts believe U.S. policies toward Iran have always been hostile, irrespective of who is in charge of the White House.
The U.S. is determined to overthrow the Iranian government, but it cannot overthrow the Iranian government. And so here we have a situation where the U.S. policy can't really succeed, and the U.S. politicians won't back away from a consensus position that exists within the American establishment.
The Biden team has repeatedly said Washington is open to talks with Tehran, stressing that the ball is in Iran's court to revive the accord. Washington says Iran must first return to full compliance and the U.S. would then rejoin the accord. Iran has, however, rejected the U.S. position, stressing that Washington must take the first step and lift all sanctions because it was the U.S. that left the agreement in the first place. The Iranian president maintained that the remarks by Iran's leader make it very clear that Tehran would fulfill all its commitments if and only if the U.S. returns to its obligations under the deal.
Now moving on. Human rights organizations say some Persian Gulf countries are spending billions of dollars on sporting events to cover up their abysmal human rights records. Bahrain, which has the most political prisoners in the world, is hosting one such event. Now 61 British MPs have written a request calling for an independent inquiry into human rights abuses there. Bianca Rahimi reports.
Bahrain has hosted yet another Formula One Grand Prix. British athlete Lewis Hamilton added to his well-deserved fame by winning the first race of 2021. But in the run-up to the event, Hamilton used his platform to raise awareness about human rights abuses in the country. In November, he received a letter from the son of Bahraini political prisoner Ahmed Ramadan, asking for the athlete to help save his father from execution. Rights groups say he confessed under torture, a common tactic used in Bahraini prisons. Hamilton has since spoken to lawyers, Amnesty International, and the Bahraini ambassador. On the eve of the Grand Prix in Bahrain, he said,
I don't think that we should be going to these countries and ignoring what is happening in those places, arriving, having a great time, and then leave.
But sports organizations have been doing just that. Civil servant Najah Yousaf was jailed in 2017 for demanding the Grand Prix be cancelled. That year, the event went ahead regardless, and for the next 3 years, Yousaf was denied legal representation, raped, and psychologically tortured in prison. Ahead of this year's event, 61 British MPs urged Formula One's new CEO to establish an independent inquiry into abuses linked to the Bahrain Grand Prix and to meet with victims and rights groups before the race to secure their compensation. Needless to say, that didn't happen.
No one wants to see their favorite sport being hijacked or used as a smokescreen for dark and sinister human rights abuses to continue unchecked. And fans have accused Lewis Hamilton now of politicising the sport because of his solidarity with the Black Lives Movement and his inquiries on the ongoing situation in Bahrain. But people in such highly visible international audiences are, of course, expected to be outspoken when they are benefiting exponentially from the public profile that they have. And they know that their silence will be seen as complicity.
Now Formula One has signed a 10-year, $650 million deal with Saudi Arabia, which, according to human rights organization Grant Liberty, has spent at least $1.5 billion on sports washing, hosting Formula E, the Dakar Rally, wrestling, tennis, the Spanish and Italian Super Cups, and European Tour Golf over the last 2 years. Amnesty International says, like all of them, Formula One will be used to sportswash the kingdom's, quote, appalling human rights record, let alone the Saudi-led war on Yemen that has killed and displaced hundreds of thousands of people and pushed a nation to the brink of famine. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The giant container ship, which had been stuck across Egypt's Suez Canal for nearly a week, is now on the move. Authorities say Ever Given made its way toward the Egyptian town of Ismailia, and that vessels were now traveling south toward the Red Sea. The Suez Canal Authority chairman said 113 ships have crossed the channel from both sides by Egypt, or by 8, I should say, PM GMT. The Ever Given had become jammed diagonally across a southern section of the canal in high winds early last Tuesday, halting traffic on the shortest shipping route between Europe and Asia. The incident created disruptions in the global shipping industry as around 30% of the world's shipping container volume moves through the Suez Canal daily. Well, that's your world news for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
As China's capabilities match and inevitably surpass those of the U.S. military, Washington will find itself pushed out of the Indo-Pacific region, and its status as the world's so-called superpower will have been erased. We now present you an article written by Brandon J. Weichert, the author of Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower. The piece is titled, America Losing the Future to China. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Brandon J. Weichert's article. Few Americans realize it, but their country's dominance in high technology innovation is now in question. This is something that Google's former chief executive officer, Eric Schmidt, acknowledged in his recent testimony before U.S. Congress. Meanwhile, Elon Musk, a business magnate, industrial designer, and engineer, has stated that China will become the world's premier economy and world power, in large part because of Beijing's consistent investment in high technology innovation. Whether it be artificial intelligence or space technology, China is rapidly becoming a dominant player in high technology development. As these trends intensify over the next decade, China's military superiority over the United States will naturally increase as well. For example, at the end of February, China surprised Western intelligence services with the sudden launch of a trio of Yuagan 331 satellites. As U.S. Senator Gary Peters, a Democratic member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, noted, this was the third launch since 31st of January, a clear indication that China's capabilities are rapidly catching up with those of the United States. As China's capabilities match and inevitably surpass those of the U.S. military, Washington will find itself pushed out of the Indo-Pacific region, and its status as the world's so-called superpower will have been erased. The Yaogan constellation was inaugurated in 2006 with the launch of China's first synthetic aperture radar satellite for constant all-weather imaging of the Earth. Just a year later, the constellation's first optical satellite was deployed. By 2009, the first trio of Yaogan electronic reconnaissance satellites were added to the growing constellation. Terrorist experts believe that the Yaogan satellite constellation is akin to the U.S. Naval Ocean Surveillance System. These satellites intercept radio signals from the ground and use them to triangulate and track the position of warships at sea. This is an essential evolution in China's growing naval and space capabilities. Yaogan will allow China's rapidly modernizing military to monitor increasingly vulnerable American military units operating near China. The key strategic aim for China is to deter U.S. military intervention into the Indo-Pacific. The Yaogan satellite constellation's ability to track and target U.S. naval assets is essential for China's growing anti-access area denial strategy. In fact, Beijing has taken extraordinary steps to protect the Yaogan constellation itself from American anti-satellite attack. In 2018, for example, a small co-orbital satellite was deployed alongside one of the surveillance satellites of the Yaogan constellation. No one knows what the co-orbital satellite's mission was. My colleague, Brian Cho, has nicknamed these co-orbital satellites space stalkers. In peacetime, these tiny and maneuverable systems can be used to repair larger satellites remotely. However, in wartime, they can be fashioned into devastating space weapons. Space stalkers could serve as bodyguards for sensitive satellites like those in the Yaogan constellation. These bodyguards could deflect American anti-satellite attack against satellites belonging to the Yaogan constellation. This would keep the Yaogan constellation operating in a war with the United States, increasing China's military superiority over the U.S. military forces in the Indo-Pacific region. Many American strategists believe that as China becomes more reliant on satellites over the next decade, the U.S. armed forces will be able to hold China hostage by threatening these vulnerable satellite constellations. Yet the presence of space stalkers among sensitive Chinese satellite constellations indicates an added layer of protection that American systems otherwise lack. Therefore, deterrence will be difficult to impose from Washington. And China will still possess an asymmetrical advantage. China needs systems like the Yaogan satellite constellation to keep the U.S. military just over the horizon in the Indo-Pacific. The harder it is for the United States to deploy forces reliably to fight Chinese forces in the South or East China Seas, the greater the advantage Beijing enjoys over Washington. Yet China's growing military capabilities have only occurred because the United States prematurely surrendered in the race for high technology development. David P. Goldman outlines in his recent book, while the United States has grown complacent, Beijing has identified key strategic industries that they want China to capture. By capturing high-technology fields like those of quantum computing, space technology, biotechnology, or artificial intelligence, China will become the center of the world. Once China is the source of innovation for the new industrial revolution, its military will naturally grow in capabilities. Beijing could force fundamental changes to the international order that has long favored America. With each new development, China's strategic military superiority over the United States grows. Over time, as per Beijing's design, the balance of power will shift in China's favor, and that balance is unlikely to shift back to the United States, as China becomes the center of the new high-technology industrial revolution. America must create a long-term strategy for high-technology research and development before China leapfrogs the United States technologically over the next decade, not only becoming the world's largest economy, but eventually surpassing the U.S. military. If a federal research and development strategy is not developed and implemented soon, the United States will lose the future to China, just as both Eric Schmidt and David Goldman fear. As Donald Rumsfeld, the former U.S. Defense Secretary, once said, "We are on notice, but we have not noticed." Here's to hoping Washington notices soon.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Hello and welcome. My name is Amina Taylor, and we begin here in the British capital with our top story. More anger and outrage across the country as the ruling Conservative government ignores calls to scrap its new policing bill. Now, the draft legislation is yet to become law, but the way British police have dealt with protest over the past few weeks, well, it's given everyone a taste of how peaceful protests might be treated once they're awarded their new powers. Chris Bambury, the author and political commentator, is with us. Chris, your thoughts on this rather divisive bill?
We should remember that in the United Kingdom, the right to protest, the right to assembly, was not something given to us. It was something that had to be won, and by defying the law, just the right to vote had to be done that, achieved that way as well. So, I mean, we should be aware as well what they have given us, what the British Labour forced to give us over decades and centuries. They are quite prepared to take away. And this bill goes a long way to take away the right to assembly and the right to protest by putting weak restrictions on that protest, restrictions on aggressive noise, restrictions on static protest, people just standing, having a vigil or whatever. Previously as well, you had to be aware that you were breaking a police injunction to be arrested for that. Now that's no longer the case. If you're unaware of it, you haven't seen the police, We haven't heard an announcement on going to demonstration. You could be arrested, that's no defense. And I could continue, but what we're seeing is that this bill is quite a pronounced attack on our right to demonstrate and assemble by a government, right-wing government, where, for instance, the whole secretary, Priti Patel, described the Black Lives Matter protest as dreadful. It's announced the climate protest we see in London as well as criminal. So therefore, they're a right-wing agenda that has to appear. And this fits with a pattern across Europe, whether it's in Spain, whether it's in France, where increasingly tight legislation is being introduced. For instance, the gag law in Spain being extended in France, so you can be jailed for insulting a member of the police or the special forces, or indeed the royal family. So it reminds us that neoliberalism is not liberal in the sense of the way most people understand it. It's liberal in terms of being free market economics, but it's not liberal in terms of our rights. These are being eroded right across Europe, and this is now happening in Britain with this sweet bill.
Now, whilst, Chris, there has been some very vocal protests there, what impact might this have if the bill goes all the way up through the House of Lords?
Well, I think the most important thing is the sweet attack on the vigil for the murdered woman, Sarah Everard, in London. Really began a debate about this bill. It brought the bill to people's attention in a way which, at the moment, it seemed to be slipping past getting through Parliament. The opposition party, Labour, was going to vote for this, was not going to vote against this bill. The protests have led to a growing awareness among young people, but not just young people, trade unionists, for instance, and others, about the reality of what's at stake here. There's also other groups affected. The Roma and travelling communities are also being targeted under this legislation. So increasingly, I think there's now a debate about the bill, and Labour have been forced to shift, saying to put against it, which is something. So I think there's a possibility that we can stop this bill. But that requires the protest continuing, the protest we've seen, despite police repression, the sort of things you saw in the package, and it's fierce in Bristol. And despite the ridiculous claims of good speech, which have been forced in class, like police officers have been wounded and things like that. So the key thing is that the protests have got to continue. We've got to keep this debate going, and we've got to try and use extra parliamentary means, because this government has got the majority in the House of Commons to vote this bill through. So it's going to take action on the street, in my opinion, to stop this bill, and increasing the involvement of people, trade unionists, for instance, the Muslim community, who should be worried about this. Other groups need to be getting involved in this. Not just the younger people we're seeing demonstrating in Bristol, in Manchester, and other centres as your package.
All right. Chris Bambury, thank you, as always. Now to some other news there. French senators will meet this week to debate President Emmanuel Macron's controversial Islamist separatism bill, which aims to root out so-called religious extremism in the wake of terror attacks perpetrated by extremists. Critics, however, see the draft bill as a tool that tarnishes the entire Muslim population and panders to growing right-wing populism. Now, last year, President Macron described Islam as a religion in crisis all over the world. French Muslims have already seen laws targeting the hijab, as well as halal poultry farming, and are now braced for more measures targeting their beliefs and way of life. The draft law would broaden the government's powers to close places of worship that have so-called ties to foreign funding and preach extremist ideologies. Various mosques, Islamic charities, and campaign groups fighting Islamophobia have already been shut down. Boris Johnson is a man on the fire for his handling of the COVID crisis and the reaction to the policing bill, but it's a story that broke over the weekend that will be causing concern in Westminster, as Ahmed Caballo fills us in on this one. Ooh, Ahmed.
So many people have suspected this to be true, but now it's been confirmed by the other party, Jennifer Akuri, that she did have an affair, a four-year affair, with Boris Johnson. Now, because of that, Tory corruption, Boris is a liar, and Boris affair has been trending on social media. And people are not just concerned with the fact that Boris Johnson lied on camera many times and denied any involvement with this woman in a romantic sense, but more to do with the fact of when he was Mayor of London, she was awarded £126,000 in sponsorships and grants. She was taken on business trips alongside Boris Johnson, paid for by the British taxpayer. And some are concerned that there was a serious conflict of interest regarding Boris Johnson and this woman and the business deals that she was part of. And this is some of the reactions that we started to see on social media. So first tweet by John says, look, the fact that he had an affair while his ex-wife was being treated for cancer shouldn't be any of our business. But once it's established that he sent a courier £126,000 of public money as mayor while this affair was going on, that becomes serious. Sue says, how sad that as a nation we aren't surprised a prime minister has lied again and no longer expected to be a resignation issue. These things now are really sad. Boris affair, Boris the liar, hashtag Tory corruption. Now it's interesting because this story has obviously made its way on some newspapers, but it hasn't got the mainstream coverage that it deserves. And some think that the mainstream media have been covering up for Boris Johnson. And we've actually got a clip from Andrew Marr where he's actually going through the papers on Sunday, and he goes through all the different newspapers with their headlines. But the paper at the bottom, which is the Daily Mirror paper, which talks about the affair and talks about what the four-year kind of arrangement between Boris Johnson and this woman, he completely misses it out and moves on to his guests and completely refuses to talk about it. And it kind of speaks to the fact that when it comes to the Tory party, there seems to be very selective coverage in terms of shielding them from the criticism with regards to extramarital affairs and regards to dodgy business deals, which seem to be associated with the Conservative Party at the moment.
Now, of course, they are the party in the past that were of family values, law and order, you know, some of these bedrock kind of marquee statements. But the rest of your choices here on social media perhaps see through that a little bit.
Yeah, it does. So we've got two more tweets on this. So Kerry says, Boris Johnson cheated with a lover on his sofa in his family home while his wife was away. The PM is the sort of man we all warn our daughters to stay away from. No respect for women, zero family values, moralist and dirty. Yeah, you can see she's not holding back there. And a final tweet from John. He says, the fact that Boris Johnson had a four-year affair and it didn't even make the news on the BBC or ITV main news is shocking. Even Mar covered up the newspaper. And there's one more angle to this story, Amina. Now, last time something like this happened in an imperialist nation, it was the United States, and it was Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. And the way, because the mainstream media in the United States made such a big deal out of it, the way that Bill Clinton distracted the public was by bombing the pharmaceutical factory in Sudan. So in some ways, people in the global south should feel lucky that the mainstream media isn't making as big a deal about this story as it deserves, because if they were, who knows what the consequences could be.
Well, anything to shift the news agenda, some might argue. Thank you very much, Ahmed Kabbalah. Now we go across to Armenia, where the country's embattled prime minister has confirmed that he will step down from the post in April in order to allow for early parliamentary elections to take place. Nikol Pashinyan has faced weeks of protest calling for his resignation in the wake of Armenia's defeat in last year's conflict with Azerbaijan. Pashinyan will step down in April but will remain in office as the interim prime minister until the June 20th elections take place. The country has been facing months of anti-government protest after Pashinyan signed a Russian brokered peace deal ceding swathes of land to neighboring Azerbaijan following the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. To Slovakia now, where the country's prime minister has stated that he will step down amidst the country's political crisis which was triggered by him unilaterally choosing to buy the Russian Sputnik V vaccine. Igor Matovich said he will switch places with the country's current finance minister, Eduard Heger, who will become the new prime minister. Slovakia became the second European Union country after Hungary to register Sputnik amidst shortages of the Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca jabs approved by Brussels. The Russian vaccine, which according to Moscow trials boosts an efficacy rate of 91%, is still awaiting the green light by the bloc's regulator, the European Medicines Agency. The reactions to a British teacher who was suspended for showing a class of students an offensive cartoon of Prophet Muhammad have continued to pour in. In Britain, an online petition demanding the complete sacking of the Batley Grammar School teacher has surpassed 25,000 signatures and continues to grow. Whilst in Egypt, Al-Azhar, the Sunni Muslim world's foremost religious institution, has strongly denounced the display of offensive cartoons, which had been earlier republished by the disgraced French satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo. Human rights organizations say Persian Gulf states are spending billions of dollars on sports events to cover up their abysmal human rights record. The Formula One Grand Prix, hosted by Bahrain over the weekend, won such event. Formula One has now signed a $1 million contract with Saudi Arabia as well, notorious for human rights abuses and leading the war on Yemen. Bianca Rahimi tells us more in the next report.
Bahrain has hosted yet another Formula One Grand Prix. British athlete Lewis Hamilton added to his well-deserved fame by winning the first race of 2021. But in the run-up to the event, Hamilton used his platform to raise awareness about human rights abuses in the country. In November, he received a letter from the son of Bahraini political prisoner Ahmed Ramadan, asking for the athlete to help save his father from execution. Rights groups say he confessed under torture, a common tactic used in Bahraini prisons. Hamilton has since spoken to lawyers, Amnesty International, and the Bahraini ambassador. On the eve of the Grand Prix in Bahrain, he said,
"I don't think that we should be going to these countries and ignoring what is happening in those places, arriving, having a great time, and then leave."
But sports organizations have been doing just that. Civil servant Najah Yusuf was jailed in 2017 for demanding the Grand Prix be cancelled. That year, the event went ahead regardless, and for the next 3 years, Yusuf was denied legal representation, raped, and psychologically tortured in prison. Ahead of this year's event, 61 British MPs urged Formula One's new CEO to establish an independent inquiry into abuses linked to the Bahrain Grand Prix and to meet with victims and rights groups before the race to secure their compensation. Needless to say, that didn't happen.
No one wants to see their favorite sport being hijacked or used as a smokescreen for dark and sinister human rights abuses to continue unchecked. And fans have accused Lewis Hamilton now of politicising the sport because of his solidarity with the Black Lives Movement and his inquiries on the ongoing situation in Bahrain. But people in such highly visible international audiences are of course expected to be outspoken when they are benefiting exponentially from the public profile that they have, and they know that their silence will be seen as complicity.
Now Formula One has signed a 10-year, $650 million deal with Saudi Arabia, which, according to human rights organization Grant Liberty, has spent at least $1.5 billion on sports washing, hosting Formula E, the Dakar Rally, wrestling, tennis, the Spanish and Italian Super Cups, and European Tour Golf over the last 2 years. Amnesty International says, like all of them, Formula One will be used to sportswash the kingdom's, quote, appalling human rights record, let alone the Saudi-led war on Yemen that has killed and displaced hundreds of thousands of people and pushed a nation to the brink of famine. Bianca Rahimi, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Before we update you with a particular angle on the ensuing chaos in the Suez Canal, we've got Robert Inlakesh for a story that has some real lasting global implications here. We're talking another social media giant and another case, some say, of censorship. Robert.
Well, Venezuela has come out and called Facebook's actions, that's banning for 30 days the president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, for speaking on what he has called as a potential cure or something that can remedy the coronavirus as digital totalitarianism. And a lot of people have came out criticizing this move as well, saying that the banning of Donald Trump set a precedent. Now they're going after other leaders, and these big social media giants feel that they can act with impunity, banning whatever opinions they want. We've seen this also affect other agencies, Press TV, of course, being one of them, having their pages taken down. In this case, we are looking at something specific to the coronavirus. However, a lot of people have been speculating, why now is it that they decide to take down Nicolas Maduro for talking about something which has been a product which has been developed inside of Venezuela and not, to anyone's knowledge, been tested inside of the West as to its efficacy rating or how well it works. And it's just so easy for them to go after a world leader and take that world leader's platform away from them online so that they cannot communicate with others. And on top of that as well, we see that media organizations, political figures, specifically, we see the targeting of activists, pro-Palestine activists as well, having their pages censored. So there is absolutely no reach, even if their page remains up. This is something that most people who post about political topics, anything that has to do with politics, which goes against the mainstream establishment, will have ran into and endured at some point.
All right, the reaction to this, I think, has been quite scathing, as you'd appreciate.
The first one we have here commenting on this is a account on Twitter called Pablo. They go by, they say, what a shame. The idea is always to give a bad image about Latin America and the rest of the world. Cuba has created its own vaccine against COVID-19. China has created 17 vaccines against COVID-19, and Russia had created 3. Just making a point there that, of course, other countries are capable of developing vaccines, and we don't really hear much coverage in a positive light of them. We've got another one here as well from Sayed Mohamed Marandi, who says, Facebook has permanently removed Press TV's page with 4 million followers. Why are they so afraid? They are already they've already removed hundreds of thousands of Iranian, Iraqi, Lebanese, Syrian, Yemeni, Afghani accounts, mine included. What are they so afraid of?
That is a valid question, Robert. Now, something else that's dominated the back and front pages here has been the ongoing situation in the Suez Canal with the blocked tanker. There has been some development, but the angle you are going for is a slightly more politicized one. Please bring me up to speed.
This story is an interesting one. Of course, it's hit headlines all over the world. This is something really of historic nature, this blockage that we've seen by a ship the size of the Empire State Building. They've said this has been managed to be wedged out. There's a large backlog behind the ship, and so this will take until the end of the week, we're hearing, to clear everything going through. But one interesting aspect I feel like has been left out of the conversation, or at least been wedged in there subtly, if anything, is the fact that this blockage here is going to be used and is being used already to promote alternative trade routes. We know that Egypt has signed on to the One Belt, One Road initiative with China. China's utilizing the Suez Canal. And now, because of the fact that large ships like this, these sort of super tankers as well, which, of course, much of the world's trade is done with, are having to pass through the Suez, and it can't quite take them. The new trade route, which is being presented as a result of the normalization deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, is going to be advertised off of the back of this. And that could take away 16% of all traffic going through the Suez Canal, possibly more. This is a great sales pitch, and this is despite the fact that Sisi, Egyptian president, had expanded the Suez Canal back in 2015. So,
all right, give me your tweet of choice, Robert.
So we're going to go to the tweet we pulled up here from Syrian Girl. She says, days before the Ever Given got lodged in the Suez Canal, Israel was pushing its alternative canal plan in the media, and now they are continuing to do so. This is JSOLS, that's the Jewish state in Levant. That's what she's saying it stands for, a plan to get crowdfunding or something, hashtag Suez blocked.
All right, we'll leave it there. Interesting to ponder that one. And thank you so much for being with us for this edition of The Bulletin. Please stay there until next time.
In the limelight.
The Saudi-led US-backed invasion of Yemen has stolen many things from Yemeni people. But for the country's disabled, it has taken away their future freedom and independence. Dear listeners, this was